this week on the Inside Flap.
He hasn't read it yet, but I've got like 50 copies over here.
Hey, let's get him a copy.
I have like a ton of copies that got delivered the other day. So I think I'm going to send him a copy and dedicate it, you know, to him, and we'll see.
Yeah.
He claims he didn't read my first book, which I don't believe in the slightest.
No, we can't believe that. Yeah.
No. Dad and I have a good relationship. You know, we meet each other at our, like, boundary.
Monday, I pull into the garage, and I smell like it smells like burnt, like a sickly sweet burnt caramel flavor or odor.
It's been warm also. I'm like, we had a blizzard, but it's been warm. Right.
What in the heck is this? And then suddenly I remember the ice cream in the back of my truck.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for this Inside Chat edition as we prepare for our spring break. I guess Andrew's been on spring break. He's still
his
down.
His spring break is this week, right?
That's right. He's down in Mexico with his family. We will be leaving tomorrow morning for our trip to San Diego. And of course, we are me, who is this guy?
Thought we had a joint jingle I didn't know about.
No, we do not. I just I got a little discombobulated there, so I got out of order. Anyway, seated across the table from me is Laura Medicus.
Howdy. No music? What's going on?
Laura Medicus.
Do I usually play that?
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't think no, I don't.
There's usually music behind me when I say
Howdy. Well, the theme music.
I'm a little thrown off now by you.
Look, it's been a long week. The kids are so, like, they don't want to do anything.
They amped
and
up.
Today, it was a half day for the kids. It is the day before That's spring nice. Break. They are amped up. They don't want to do anything, so it's been a long day.
Nice they had a half day.
It really is. It really is. And here we are. But we're glad you are joining us.
The Inside Flap.
We have a great guest for you. We're joined by Garrett Conley, author of the memoir Boy Erased, his first novel, which is, it'll go on sale March 26th. It is called All the World Beside. It is a fascinating read. Had a great chat with Garrett, and we'll have that for you shortly. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about our, so we just wrapped up Strike Week for Urinetown, which is when all the actors get to come in and take down the set and all that stuff for, it only lasted 3 days this time because we built out the stage and we didn't have to break it down. I pulled the music teacher aside. I said, listen, you want this stage for
what
your,
happens if you leave it? Don't you have to break it down at some point? Or?
We're just going to see how long it'll stay
good idea.
Up. It's built all over the... It brings the audience closer to the action.
Doesn't it out some seats, though?
A couple rows.
Not bad, though.
But it's a huge auditorium, so not bad at all.
How many people do you think that auditorium sits?
I don't have any
idea. Sylvia had heard they sold 500 tickets one night.
That's possible, yeah.
So it must sit like 600, 700, because you guys didn't even fill the upper balcony.
No, we don't sit in the, we don't have any seating in the balcony.
Yeah, it's like going into an old theater.
It is.
It's like bigger than an old theater, though. Like one of those old, like the Senator
like an old
in Baltimore.
Movie house, yeah.
Old movie house.
Except the chairs have not been refurbished since the 20s and they're
it's
hard.
Just
and
like the old movie houses.
And it's really bad.
Yeah.
So, as you recall, when we had our strike from our fall play, Antigone, we had a great deal of sand that was used for that play.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that sand, we got rid of some of it, but the majority of it was still sitting
really
outside the back entrance to the school.
Oh.
And I kept getting, Dean Anderson kept giving me grief about it until the one day when a massive load of paint spilled. Like right near where our sand was, and they just dumped a bunch of sand
on top of the paint.
On top of the paint.
Oh, like you do with barf? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. Or gasoline or something like that. But
who did
I said,
that?
So my ineptitude really saved you and saved the school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so finally we're like, all right, we need to finally get rid of this sand. So we put the actors from the musical, a lot of them in charge of getting rid of the sand. And this is how we did it. So
I'm super curious. I don't know about this.
I said to them, I said, because in the fall it was a disaster. We had them fill up buckets and they took it over to like a dog park and dumped a bunch of it in a dog park.
That's weird.
Or we like right near the school there.
Everyone take a cup and then dump it in the park on their way home.
Yeah, that kind of like Shawshank Redemption, you know, put it in the hems of your pants.
Exactly.
No, I dug like a little trench by the school on the outside of the school and had kids fill it.
That's funny.
Like next to the foundation. And one of the English teachers, J.J. Clark, he came by. He's like, this is a historic building. You can't do that. He's just joking, of course. But so this is what I told them to do.
Dug a trench.
We got all the buckets from down in the basement from the custodial staff. We had like 15 buckets.
Okay.
I had two kids on shovels. I said, you guys are on shovel duty. And they called themselves the head of shovel. Because in the stagecraft class, we have the different departments, costume, props, set, and so on. And each department has a different head.
Head boy.
So, that's right. So they were calling themselves head of shovel. And then we had head of bucket. And so the way it worked was the two kids with the shovels, the head of shovels, would not fill up the buckets, because these are like the 5-gallon Home Depot buckets. Mm-hmm. They would fill it up like halfway. Then I had a couple of kids schlepping the buckets over to our south lawn. It's a huge
lawn. I know the south lawn.
Right? You know the south lawn. You can see it right off of Colfax there. And then I passed by
East today.
Oh, okay. How about that?
Drove right past the Carla Madison.
Were you able to see piles of sand on the south lawn?
I really wish I'd looked.
Well, here's the thing. You couldn't see them because this is what I tasked them with. I said, listen, we can't just dump three tons of sand.
Wow.
And you can't just dump a bucket here. So I said, I just grabbed the bucket and I kind of like went back and forth with it.
Okay, yeah.
And then even then you could still see sand. So we got a rake and then I was like, you just rake it up. Well, this is what they figured out. And these two girls, Anna and Sasha,
I know Anna from
the trip to England.
Mm-hmm.
They called themselves the head of frolic because this is what
the
head of frolic.
I like that.
Because what they did with the sand, they awesome. Got really excited. They came inside to find me so they could show me the technique.
Oh, I love it.
That they mastered.
They get a little dance going on, or
what they would do is they would hold the bucket out in front of, like, hold it against their stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would kind of swivel around.
Wow.
Like go around in a circle.
That's
but as
awesome.
They did, they'd slowly tilt the bucket out. And so it would lightly scatter it all around. So you couldn't even tell.
Wow.
There was any sand being dumped on the south lawn.
Did anybody
I told them, listen, here's what I said to them. I said, if anybody asks, you tell them we're on conservation club and this is water retention. I didn't even know what that, I don't know, I still don't know what that means, but
that's
I said,
funny.
Just tell them water retention. And then one kid, Jacob, you know, played Officer Lockstock.
Oh, yeah, I love him.
He came into the building at one point. He goes, Dave, there's some woman out there wants to talk to you. Said her name is Tarina. Which is, of course, our principal.
Madam Principal.
So my heart sunk, but then he started laughing. And I said, Jacob, you never do that.
For people who haven't seen him play Officer Lockstock, he is a ninth grade boy with an air of authority I've never seen a ninth grade boy have.
This kid is unbelievable.
He has an air and a presence and a charisma.
You wouldn't guess in a million years that this kid was a freshman.
He could tell you he's the head of like the Harvard business, whatever. And you'd be like, oh, okay.
So we got rid of, we got rid of 2 to 3 tons of sand just by frolicking about in the south lawn. It was absolutely amazing.
I bet
amazing.
It was fun.
Yeah, the kids.
They made it fun.
The kids on the detail where you just had to schlep the buckets back and
that's
forth
did not
enjoy it.
No, that's a workout though.
Yeah, it was a workout. And the kids with the shovels, Sonny was one of the kids on the shovels.
Oh no.
He kept finding moss. He would find, like, because this sand had been sitting out for a long time and covered with a tarp. He was finding pieces of moss.
Huh.
because it's damp. And he would like put it in his pocket. He's like, I'm like, Sonny, what are you doing? With the moss? I'm taking it home to my terrarium. I have a moss collection.
Oh, that's a good idea. He has a moss. Sonny has a moss collection.
He has a moss collection.
Huh.
Yeah.
Sonny is a kid who, when we went to London last year, there was a gag. It started out with a funny little thing, just like a woman named Torito wants to talk to you.
Oh, right.
There was a gag where a kid says to you, hey, Dave, where's Sonny?
Yeah, because they thought it'd be hilarious to imagine someone going
panicked.
Missing.
Panicked. And so then, because that gave them great joy, because they saw how upset you were, the rest of the trip, it was, hey, Dave, where's Sonny?
Well, it wasn't just the rest. It was the rest of the school year. They continued it on when we got back to school.
Because
Peyton every day would come up to me, Dave, where's Sonny?
It made Peyton laugh so hard, though.
It was that was a lot of fun.
That gave me joy, was seeing Peyton have the joy.
That's true.
Every time they said it.
So we got everything struck. And the last thing was we had on the last day, I guess it was before a strike, but it was the last performance on Sunday afternoon. We had a nice ice cream social for the kids, and we had seniors from the past or graduates, as
they sat right in front of me, a lot of
them from the past. They came in to serve the kids ice cream.
So cool.
And first of all, Anna Kay, she was mad because her husband was late bringing. They got ice cream from Little Man.
Ooh,
Little
that's Man. A nice one.
I was thinking Little Man Tate. I think that Jodie Foster
movie. That's a movie. Little Man Ice Cream.
Little
we used
Man
to live
ice
near
cream.
It.
Exactly.
They had a stainless steel slide. That in the summertime
Sylvia
when you are eating ice cream is 135 degrees.
Yeah, and she would always want to get on there and burn herself.
Yeah.
That was weird. I forgot
about
that.
It's a local ice cream shop, though.
Yeah, delicious ice cream. So at the end of it...
That is not cheap.
Like one of the... And they had 5-gallon tubs of it, a couple of different flavors.
That's classy.
Yeah, it is. And Anna Kay is like, I got this... there's like 4 gallons still remaining in this 5-gallon bucket.
Wow.
Dave, do you want it? Huh. I said, sure. Well, are you kidding me?
We have ice cream? No.
Hold on.
Okay.
So I grabbed this tub of ice cream.
Yeah.
I was very excited. I put it in the back of my truck.
Oh, Dave.
Drove home. And because, listen, you got to remember, this was...
I know. You're tired.
You know, 10 straight days of being at school.
I was tired.
You came and watched the show.
And I was exhausted.
Yeah. I was in the orchestra, of course, overseeing... Sure. All the technical details of the show and everything. Oh, I'm so exhausted. And so I come home with the ice cream. I pull up in the garage. I forget about this 5-gallon bucket of ice cream.
How much money was that?
It wasn't cheap.
No.
Go to school the next day, Monday. Go about my business. And because Andrew got me that cover for the back of my truck.
Nice.
I can't see into the back of my truck anymore.
So you're going to blame Andrew on this one.
It is Andrew's fault. It's too bad. He's not here to defend
Andrew!
Himself, so we'll just blame it on him. Drive home Monday. I pull into the garage, and I smell it smells like burnt, like a sickly sweet burnt caramel flavor or odor.
It's been warm also.
And I'm like,
we had a blizzard, but it's been warm.
Right. What in the heck is this? And then suddenly I remember the ice cream in the back of my truck. So I open up the back of my truck, and sure enough, there's the tub. It's lying on its side. There's a puddle of what is now, it's like solidified ice cream next to the tub. And what has happened? Because, in the back of a pickup truck, the bed, it's got little holes in it to allow for drainage. So what has happened?
Drainage for ice cream.
So now I'm guessing the ice cream has drifted down through the little holes and has attached to like the exhaust pipe or something, because now every time I get out of my truck after driving to work or home, I smell this burnt caramel.
What flavor was the ice cream?
Vanilla.
Vanilla. Oh, vanilla.
My favorite, because then you can just add chocolate syrup to it.
Some vanilla.
You add sprinkles to it. You add cherries to it. It's it's a good base for whatever. You can add caramel syrup.
You don't have to defend vanilla. I was just wondering.
But so that's what's going
on.
That's
really
with my
funny.
Truck.
Is it sticky or did you wash it out?
Oh, I went to the car wash.
Oh, good.
I took the lid off of it. I went to the car wash thinking that'll...
I thought that might do it too.
No.
No.
It still smells like burnt caramel.
Wow, it's going to smell like that for a while. All summer.
Yeah, it doesn't when you first get in it.
Is it a good smell? Because sometimes I like the smell of burnt caramel.
Originally, the first day, I was like, man, someone is cooking up. And when I pulled up that Monday morning to school, I'm like, man, someone is cooking up something. Smells great. And it wasn't until when I got home Monday afternoon and I smelled the exact same smell. I'm like, that person near City Park in Denver is not here in my garage. What is the common factor? Oh, yeah, it's my truck, and it's probably the...
That's really funny.
Ice cream container.
I like that.
All right, anyway, let's get on with the show. We have great guests for you. Garrett Conley, his new book is All the World Beside. Now, I read this book, really enjoyed it. This is set in a small community called Cana in 18th century Puritan New England, and it tells the story of Reverend Nathaniel Whitfield and physician Arthur Lyman. Both these gentlemen are married, they both have children, but they both are in love with each other, which is something, I don't know if you know this, but the Puritans, they kind of frown upon that. So both these men do their best to keep this relationship a secret from the community, which is a burden shared by their families. This is extremely well written, a fascinating read about humanity and love and being true to yourself. Really enjoyed this one. And just a great conversation and a great chat with Garrett. So here now talking about his book, All the World Beside. This is Garrett Conley.
This is not really, this is not really happening. You bet your life.
Got it real close. It's Garrett. It's such a strange family name.
I didn't get it.
I mean, I just answered anything with like a G or a J sound because my parents cursed me with a name that no one can pronounce.
That's really funny.
I hope you keep them on notice at all times. I do have a question about your father, but we'll get to that.
I'm sure we'll get there.
But thanks for hopping on. Where are we talking to you from?
I'm in Atlanta right now. I teach at Kennesaw State University. Basically we're on spring break right now.
Oh, nice. So,
wild and crazy right now. Just in my apartment.
That's really funny. Yeah, I knew Kennesaw, Georgia. I have a friend who I think might have gone to that college a long time ago. Yeah,
it's a nice place to be. My colleagues are wonderful. The students are like, you know, I get a nice mix of like shell-shocked queer students from like the middle of nowhere in Georgia. And then like
those poor things.
I know. But it's good. It's like, it's healing, you know, on both sides, I think.
Do they come running to you for guidance? They've all read your book and they're like, help me, Garrett!
Yeah, it does start to happen. It's kind of funny. Like, I guess it's like a bit self-selective in terms of who signs up for my classes, because I'll be like, oh, okay, I'm sorry, the one straight dude in here. That's going to be fine. You're welcome.
It's going to be fine. It'll all work out for you. Yeah.
That's really funny. That's hilarious. Well, listen, Garrett, let's talk about your new book, which I absolutely loved, All the World Beside. Listen, this is a tale of visions, of awakenings, and why you should put flour on floorboards. Garrett, what was it that inspired you? I learned a lot in this book. What was it that one
was a weird detail. I'm glad that you focused in on that, because I was always self-conscious about that one. I was like, well, maybe that went a little too far. But I did actually look up at one point in my like very disorganized but very determined research process. I was like, okay, so if someone has an issue with loud boards in the past, what do they do? And some obscure source somewhere in like some handbook I was reading, I'm sure, said to sprinkle flour between the floorboards. And I thought, what a strange and sort of almost haunting image.
Yeah, it is.
So that's what I wanted to do. I like those little creepy...
No, that detail was great. I think it was so great. You might have actually mentioned it twice. It was.
I mentioned it several times. I know.
It was a good one. But Garrett, what was it that inspired you to write this book?
It's a long story, but basically my husband, Shahab, said to me one day about 7 years ago, "Hey, what if you wrote about queer Puritans?" And I laughed at him.
Or as you should have. Yeah.
Sounds like a joke, right?
Yeah.
But then the longer I thought about it, I thought, okay, that's a challenge, right? How do you write about people in the past without using our identity markers today? And then, I like a good language challenge. So I started reading a lot of Jonathan Edwards' sermons. I don't know if y'all ever read anything from Edwards.
I don't know if I've read it, but I know of him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a big deal still in New England. And I think we'd probably find much of his theology a bit odious today, but he was much more than the sort of fire and brimstone sermon creator that he later was, described as, because a lot of kids read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which is a very famous sermon. And it's like, wow, you shouldn't be teaching that to like ninth graders. They're going to be so afraid right now of dying and burning in hell forever they aren't already. But he was so much more than that. And it actually sort of opened up a conversation with my father, who I know we're getting to anyway. He is a missionary Baptist preacher, and I've always been fascinated with the idea of, where did he get his theological underpinnings? Because, the Anabaptists are still very different from the Baptists. And, he's certainly a far cry from the Congregationalists like Jonathan Edwards, who were very much educated at like Harvard and Yale and like had a very controlled logic. And so I was like, okay, well, what's the gap between those two things? Because I found out that my dad also loves Jonathan Edwards. And I was like, okay, let's talk about it. If you love Jonathan Edwards, why are you so different from him? What I really started to learn was that the Great Awakening, the first and second Great Awakening in this country, the big moment where there were like suddenly revivals and a big influx of emotion from a lot of the congregants, before the 18th century in New England, there was just this sense of like staid and sober worship.
Right.
And then suddenly there was this subjective experience that was so important, right? Like I personally feel touched by God and like all the language gets way more intimate and like almost sexual.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, moved by
the Holy Spirit. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you're the Holy Spirit's moving in you. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
let him fill you up. There's a lot you can do with that and has been done in poetry for a very long time. But anything from like Gerard Manley Hopkins poetry to John Donne to, contemporary poets like Carl Phillips, there's a richness to the language that lends itself to an exploration of sex and sexuality, I think.
Interesting.
Wow. It seems like you did a lot of research, like not only on the Puritans, but also on, the history of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, when you're doing all this research, were there things that surprised you, like that were interesting, I'm assuming? Well, and then also like, how do you know when to stop? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, these are two excellent questions. first of all, let me ask what your rating is for your podcast, because when I repeat to you what I found in the 18th century, you'll be a little shocked.
Say whatever you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
put a disclaimer on.
Yeah.
Well, okay, good. For children listening, which I don't know why they'd be listening to a very literary
podcast,
but whatever.
No. We're not talking about Goodnight Moon here, for God's sakes.
We could, I'm sure, but I found these two a series of letters between two men, Virgil Maxey, which is already a gay name, and then and then William Blanding, and the first part of the letter made a lot of sense. I'd researched a lot to see like how men slept in beds together, and that wasn't seen as strange. You were traveling, trying to save money, et cetera, trying to keep warm. Mm-hmm. And I found this letter that said, I want to lie with you all night and talk to you and caress you. And I was like, okay, well, this is getting more interesting. And then suddenly the letter said, sometimes I get to thinking I have hold. Sorry, this is my cat with a hairball. So sometimes I think I get hold of your doodle, which a doodle is what you think it is, when in reality, I've got hold of the bedpost. And at that point, you're thinking, well, first of all, that's a very big doodle. And that's second of all, it's a very big doodle. Second of all, like, that's hardly in a state of repose, right?
Right. No. That's permanent.
And that is so funny. And when was that written?
Oh, it was 1800. So a little bit later for my period, but it was enough for me to start mapping it. And then
good one. So
Virgil signs off with, this is the real kicker.
Okay,
I'm going to say it. Okay, warning.
No, just go for it, yes.
Okay, your cunt humble. Literally, it says that. And I mean, we knew Shakespeare was already joking with that word and stuff with country and things like that. But I was just like shocked to see such a modern kind of modern and, Enlightenment era sounding phrase. And I started thinking like, wow, I need to change my Grindr profile name. You know, like that's a good one.
It's a good one.
That is.
That's a really good one. And then you wonder too if that's just one letter, like there must have been. It's not just one instance. Yeah, you know what
there's
I mean?
A lot going on. Yeah.
It was a lot going on. It was a letter that also spawned a very famous screed, or at least famous in like my research, by Larry Kramer, who, you know, the famous activist Larry Kramer, who did so much work to help out with ACT UP and all that stuff. And he wrote that, you know, straight historians had hijacked our history. And he used that quote because it was quoted in another historian's work, the cunt humble thing. And right after he wrote that, he said, "One cannot help but wonder." This was what the historian wrote. "One cannot help but wonder." You know, so like I get where Larry Kramer's anger came from. I don't necessarily agree entirely because I think you're never going to have like a one-to-one, like, okay, clearly this matches our sexuality that as we understand it today. You know, Larry Kramer would probably not be satisfied if we found like until we found like Abraham Lincoln's dildo or something.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just like he needs it.
Yeah.
I don't need that. Like I'm fine with like not turning retroactively like turning people that were presenting it as straight suddenly gay.
Yeah.
Like I don't need to do that to justify the existence of queerness. But it did make me think a lot. And so I guess I wondered for 7 years and this was the result.
That's really interesting. So 7 years of another question.
Yeah.
So when you're doing this research and you're going down, are you also thinking, I'm assuming you're thinking about the story? Are you writing at all while you're doing the research too?
Yeah, I did about 6 months of just reading, which was really fun.
That's awesome.
Kind of go into that world. And it was the only time I wasn't working full time. I took it like a couple years off.
That's great.
After Boy Race to actually like do the whole writing thing. And I found that I need a day job, but I did get to take like just a full 6 months of like waking up and reading, which is such a privilege, you know, and I got to do that, deep dive into a lot of different areas of research. You know, I was looking at, sexuality in the 18th century by a lot of queer theorists and a lot of historians. And then I was also looking at, you know, Jonathan Edwards and that whole period and reading as many letters between men at the time that I could. And then of course I got to go on these fun journeys through like Anne Hutchinson, you know, the woman who dared to defy the Puritans about a century before my book began. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was so tough. All the men around her would say she was evil and like, you know, you can't interpret the Bible this way. And she would just get up in front of the court and say, all of you are wrong and you'll be proven wrong. And of course she ended up like dead in the wilderness. Right. But I like
how
she's
in the woods, you know, in your book too. You never want to go into the woods. Nothing good.
The woods aren't good though. It's very popcorn. the evil lives in the woods.
Yeah. It's always the trees that'll get you.
So yeah. When you're writing the dialogue for this, were you like going around to your husband and speaking in that manner? Like, how did you dial that in? Did you get out?
Did you put on a pilgrim hat?
I wish I could have put on one of those like long dresses at the time. but I did, you know, we kind of lived and breathed the 18th century for a while. I would just invite him to, I was living in New York at the time. So that was wonderful for that. Like one day I remember getting stuck on, you know, exactly how the shifts worked with the dresses. And like, I wanted to know exactly how everything was sort of fastened up, especially for formal wear. And I looked up on the internet, there was like a National Arts Book Club National Arts Club. Yeah. Meeting that night. This dressmaker was going to show people 18th century dresses and like dress someone publicly so that we could see. And so of course I went and it was so fun. And there were like drag queens there. And I was like, this is a sign. Like, this is a sign that I'm supposed to keep going.
Wow. What?
That is awesome. So New York City. That's awesome.
New York. I love New York. Yep. For that. There's a lot to not like about it, but that was wonderful. And so, yeah, we didn't exactly speak the dialogue, but I did actually, I think what was surprising to me was how studying the theology of the time so closely and having my background made it to where I started to almost regress. Like, it was like, you know, not really, but like I went down some dark paths in terms of thought because I was trying to really get into the mindset of the minister who falls in love with another man in his town, Nathaniel Whitfield in the book. And, you know, with that, there was just so much convoluted, sad, you know, sort of trains of thought that he had. And that really affected me a lot because it didn't feel that far from my own experience. Right. You know, I think that was what was surprising to me is I kept doing all this research and what I found was that humans are pretty much the same.
Yeah.
Like we just keep doing the same things, you know?
It's kind of disheartening a little bit.
We would evolve in some way, but we're just doing
I think we have on some major ways, right? Like I'm a gay writer that gets to like exist in the 21st century. But yeah, I mean, the way people treat each other maybe hasn't changed that much.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. And we were set back by a certain president for sure.
Oh God, don't even tell me.
No.
Last time my book came out,
same cycle.
Mm-hmm. Why am I following this pattern to get out of it? You're dark.
No. Larry, let's
it
not.
It won't happen, right?
Let's not talk about that. I was struck by the character of Sarah in this book. And when we first meet her, she's a young girl, but by the time she's 14, she doesn't see herself as a girl at all. But as a woman of the house. And it's interesting to me to think about the Puritans back then, like, you had to grow your ass up in a hurry fast, didn't you? There's no time to be a kid.
No. And, you know, I think there's an irony to a modern reader reading this because, you know, you're seeing Sarah at a very young age thinking like, I want to be an adult. I want to be an adult. Like a bunch of girls feel that way. Children feel that way when they're growing up. And then, you know, here you go. Your mother's basically incapacitated and you are in charge of your family's like moral well-being because of what you saw in the forest, which I won't give too much away. But you know, like she's let in on the secret of her father really early in the book and given a ton of responsibility. And it's sort of like careful what you wish for, you know. And there is an irony to the fact that Catherine, her mother, really tried to protect her from that. You know, it's called like, you know, in the book's world, like they're spoiling the child by keeping them a child. You know, children at the early age of like 7 or 8 were like barely seen as children. You know, I don't think there was really a clear concept of that. Yeah.
Oh.
So, you know, children certainly played games and stuff, and there were certain allowances given to certain kids. But yeah, I mean, 14 is kind of advanced in that world. You better start getting married soon.
That's true.
What are you doing? She's a spinster.
Exactly.
Like, the threat of concept, like serious illness, is just omnipresent. Mm-hmm. And then you have it with typhoid fever. I can't imagine. Did that into your mind too, just grow like thinking about that, and that probably has something to do with they're not really children. You can't get too attached, I would think. I don't know.
Yeah, the mortality rate for children was pretty high. I think once they reached a certain age, it got better, but definitely early on, like in the pregnancy and right after birth, things could be really scary. And there was also so much superstition at the time around midwives. So people thought that midwives were witchy, that they had associations with witches. And we're looking at a time period that is, I think barely 40 years after the Salem witch trials in that area. So I was really surprised in my research to find that the magistrates who had done all that terrible stuff, including Nathaniel Hawthorne's great, great, great grandfather, they quickly changed tune, like pretty rapidly. They were like, that was a disaster. And people mocked it pretty quickly. But this is one of the things where it's a perennial theme, right? Like we never learn. Like, it's like 40 years, and then Cana, the town that we're in my book, has so much of that. We're not killing people or putting them, tying them to the stake and burning them, but we might as well be some of them.
And you even mention Salem in the book, and you mention Anne Hutchinson, and I think it just adds to the authenticity of it. Like we're in the world, and I think I liked how you did that. So let's talk about. I'm curious. I was reading the acknowledgments, and I got a chuckle when you quote your father as saying, "When are you going to write a book I can share with other people?" And you're like, "Guess what? They're reading it. They're reading it anyway." But has your dad read this book?
He hasn't read it yet, but I've got like 50 copies over here.
Okay, let's get him a copy.
have like a ton of copies that got delivered the other day. So I think I'm going to send him a copy and dedicate it, to him, and we'll see. He claims he didn't read my first book, which I don't believe in the
Oh, no, we
slightest.
can't believe that.
No.
Interesting.
Dad and I have a good relationship. We meet each other at our like boundary pretty frequently.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, I've just decided to it's not that we ignore the harder things, the harder issues. Like I still push back and we do have fights every now and then. But I'd rather be real with a person that I love and try to meet them where they are because A, I love my dad, but B, I also feel like since he's a preacher who is in charge of like 200 people, it's an important thing to make sure that he's not spreading any vile messages with LGBTQ people. And he doesn't. He's
That's
very
good.
he doesn't put politics in his sermons. Like I told him this next election, you cannot just don't like it's a free country. Let people vote how they want. Like if
Good.
that's your attitude, just that's it.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, I wasn't going to vote for that jerk anyway. So I was like,
Oh,
oh,
nice. Hey, look at that.
okay. And I was clarifying, like, you mean the real jerk,
Yeah,
right?
that's a good
Which jerk?
point.
We're talking about
Oh, I didn't even think about that. That's a you did need to
there are
clarify
two, but there's one that's way worse.
that.
Yeah. We're not even concerned about anything else. Like it's just one
No, I just want to
obvious.
survive. I just want to, yeah, like I'm going to be strategic, but he's, yeah, dad's changed a lot,
That's great.
and it's pretty good now.
That's good.
That's great. That's really good. And you also kind of say you write about religion and sexuality so much because you other people are wanting you to just shut up about it. I like that instinct. Have you
That's
always been
great.
that way?
I'm stubborn. Yeah. And I'm also an Aries, and I think I fit that profile. I'm very headstrong and ambitious. And for me, it's like, okay, how many hours did I spend memorizing the Bible? How many days did I spend thinking about different books of the Bible? Well, I'm gonna put that to work, right? If that's it's not gonna be wasted time. It needs to be used.
That was all research, for God's sakes.
Where did you grow up?
Arkansas.
Arkansas.
Yeah, so my first town was like 100 people, and the only thing to do in town was to go to church. So
Wow.
That's where it comes from.
Yeah. You have come a long way.
It's crazy. I mean, actually,
wow, that is a bravo to you.
It creates some vertigo. You know, I feel like when I go to, I remember it most distinctly when I went to college for the first time at a small liberal arts college, like 2 hours away from home. Still Arkansas, but very different in terms of like, acceptance. And I loved that, but there was a part of that experience where my professors would ask me, you know, how's your family? Where are you from, et cetera? And they would just say things like, oh, I'm so sorry. Or like, you know, oh, there's a bunch of country bumpkins and all those stereotypes that people have about the South. And so I've always just kind of lived in this weird space between, you know, Southern states, Northern states, left and right. Like, I myself am very far left, but like I have to know how to maneuver in those circles because of all the activism I do to end conversion therapy. You know, I get sent to like churches and things like that. And people definitely don't always agree with me and I don't agree with them. But I think I truly believe still that people can change because I've seen it in my own family. And these characters in my book, you know, they do kind of change.
Yeah, like, they do.
Some more than others. They change as much as it's possible for them to change at the time. And I'm proud of them for that.
Yeah, I really, you know, these are characters. I mean, they really spoke to me. It was such, and keep writing about these themes because they're really interesting to read about.
That's great.
Did it end the way you thought it was going to end?
No. This is like, there was a pretty major overhaul of the draft midway through the process. My agent and editor conspired.
Oh no. They
got a draft and like, it was clearly, they were right. Okay. Let me just preface with that.
Okay.
They were very right, but it was very disorienting because they didn't know how to handle it. And they were like, hey, you know, this is very beautifully experimental. Also, we need to be closer to the characters and all of these pyrotechnics that you're doing, all of these like frame narratives, it's just distracting from that. Right. So I was very grateful that they did that. And then part of that process allowed me to open up the characters a lot more. And so Catherine, I won't give anything away, but sort of at the end of the novel in the epilogue, Catherine gets her, what I think of as her like second monologue in the book. The first one comes pretty early. And then she has this like interior monologue as her mind is changing that sort of allows for the language to wrap everything up, you know, metaphorically, thematically, everything sort of coheres for me with Catherine. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy because I was like, I don't know how this book's going to end. Like, how in the world am I going to give readers a sense of satisfaction or completion? And I think Catherine really allowed me to do that.
Yeah, I thought that was a beautiful way to do it. It really just, the arc came to a close right there in a very nice and beautiful way.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. But what about Humble Pie? Did you make, I didn't, what the hell? That's a real thing? Come on.
I didn't know that, yeah.
Real, with the glistening ruby of the heart. Yeah. that's that like beauty in the disturbing. But yeah, I was looking for all of the food in the book, which I'm really sad I didn't get to do like one of those fancy like tasting things with books, you know. But the publisher was not paying for that. I remember choosing each food item intentionally. You know, there were the humble pie is like coming at a time when Sarah feels exposed to something, right? She's kind of raw and her body aches and she's learning to be a woman and she's learning all of these new things from her mother. And so I just thought this like glistening heart, you know, that she's about to work into food is, it was just, it worked for me.
Nice. I can see that. I might have to go back and reread all the food scenes. but before I do that, let's get to our segment we call Quick Six. These are six quick questions, which we find out just a little bit more about you. That's right. Strap in. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Okay. So the last, I'll tell you two because I'm like simultaneously binging two. they're very different tonally. One is the new, it's that Capote versus the Swans.
Oh yeah, I'd like to see that.
So good. It's really good. I'm surprised it's so good, but it's really surprising.
Oh, I can't wait. It looks really stylish.
It's really stylish and fun and also sad. But you keep seeing like all these actresses show up and you're like, I don't know how you're here. and then the other one I started watching was that like Chucky show. Do you know the Chucky doll killer thing? So it's really surprisingly fun if you just need to like
zone out. I didn't know there was a show about.
Is it a horror show?
Killer doll. Yeah, it's really fun and very queer and like, you're like rooting for this doll to just mercilessly kill people and you're like, wait, this is wrong. Why am I feeling this way?
Oh, that sounds fun. That sounds fun.
I agree to that one. That one sounds like a lot of fun.
It is fun.
I mean, both of those two have some camp involved.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
I prefer that a little bit.
How about what fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Wow. Like live in or just visit?
We'll let you come back in.
Yeah, we'll let you back in.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you have immunity from danger.
Okay. Well, I think if I'm going to be honest, it would probably be The World of the Magicians by Lev Grossman. I love that trilogy a lot. And I always thought that Lev Grossman captured that feeling of when you're a kid and you're like so mad that you can't enter a magical world.
Yeah.
And then in those books, like when you do, it just kind of is like the same shitty like politics.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting. I'd rather be in a magical world that had shitty politics than like a non-magical one.
Good point.
I like that. Magic's always better. I like those books. Those are good.
They're fun.
That's a good answer. I don't think we've had that answer before.
Right? No, we haven't.
How about this? Give us one of your favorite movies of all time.
Beetlejuice.
Oh yeah, we just saw the musical. Have you seen the musical?
Yeah, I liked the musical, but you know, I'm like a purist with that first movie. I'm worried about the sequel that they're.
I know it's coming out. Yeah, I feel worried about that too.
But yeah, I'm really influenced by like my early loves. Like I was really into. I was nerdy. I was into like video games, like Japanese RPGs, and I would always my grandmother, she had a VHS of Beetlejuice for some reason, and we would just watch it over and over again. And I think it was the first time I really understood that a script could be brilliant in a movie that wasn't supposed to necessarily have a brilliant script. You know, there were these little lines from Otho, like the interior decorator / seance person.
Yeah.
And he's like, he says something like, I remember this line like clicking in my head and being like, I want to be a writer. Whenever he said, don't worry, she's just upset because somebody dropped a house on her sister. Okay, Wizard of Oz reference, like,
it's a great wicked.
It's just so such a fun way to say that.
Yeah. I think that's in the musical too.
I'm sure that. Why would you use that line?
You can't lose that line.
Yeah, because we did just
deliver me from LL Bean. There's so many good ones. In
that. Really good one. Yeah, please do. How about a favorite book of yours?
Favorite book. Y'all already know that one of my favorite books is The Scarlet Letter.
Right.
But I won't give you that one because it's too obvious. I really love Juno Barnes's Nightwood, which I quote at the beginning of this book. I think it was written in the 1940s. It's pretty old. And it was like a lesbian romp filled with really strange philosophical musings from a drag queen that just go on for like pages and don't even make sense. And I think it was like, was it Ezra Pound who wrote the preface to that book? I think so. Anyway, it's like she was not really that well known at the time, but her prose is just so liberating. Like when you read Juno Barnes's prose, it's really strange and funny.
Wow.
So that one really touched me. And then I guess favorite, sorry, I'm extending this too long, but I'm just going to be basic here. I guess it's basic to love Moby Dick as much as I do.
That's not basic.
I mean, Melville Hawthorne, like they kind of go together.
Yeah, that's true. They do. But that's okay.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and I think Melville, you know, this is my little side note, Melville definitely had the hots for Hawthorne, and Hawthorne did not reciprocate in the same way.
Really?
Someone should write that.
Book, maybe, that yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's an interesting one.
Yeah. How about this? Garrett, do you have a go-to... Garrett. What the hell? No.
Garrett, you got it right.
Garrett, you got it right. Yeah.
I watched. Yeah. I saw a little video of you online. I do my research.
Thank you.
Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Oh no. Let's see. What do I usually do? I usually do probably this is gonna be so funny. Probably like a Tori Amos song.
Whoa!
Like
I'm just gonna go.
Yeah,
that's Laura's
like Girl or something like that. Like really any of her classics during that period that. I just, you know, I think it's funny to try to hit her notes and fail terribly.
Yeah.
Like you have to do something that is so like vocally impossible that it's funny. Right?
That's awesome. True, yeah. That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been dragged to many a Tori Amos concert.
I hear she plays the piano with like her like thrusting her
pelvic area. Yeah, facing the audience.
She gets really into it. It's something.
The last time I saw her, I was at Red Rocks here in Colorado, and I like held hands and cried with the person.
I would too.
Yeah. We snuck down to the second row for that one. Yeah.
Yeah, right. That was amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
Well, I'm finishing up Aro Kwan's book, her new book called Exhibit, which is coming out, I think, this month or next month. We're kind of sharing book birthdays. And I really love her work. I love The Incendiaries, which were really great. It was a great book. And then, I don't know, she's kind of a person to turn to for a highly polished, very sharp sentence. She's
good.
Got it.
Oh, nice.
Very good. Yeah.
All right. Well, Garrett, listen, loved your book, All the World Beside, and it's just been a lot of fun chatting with you. Thanks so much for hopping on.
Thanks.
This was fun.
Very good. Well, enjoy the rest of your day down there in Atlanta.
Thank you. Y'all, I love the energy that y'all bring to the podcast. It's very different from most like book podcasts.
I know. We try. We don't like most.
You have to like jazz people up because sometimes I'll be listening to a podcast and I'll be like, okay, well, this is a sleep podcast. The other one I'll listen to during the day.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. We try to keep it interesting. Yeah. And you're a fun guy to talk to, so it's not that hard at all.
Thank you.
Bye. I'll have a good day.
You too. The
Inside Flap. All right, there you go. That was Garrett Conley. Appreciate him spending some time with us. Check out his book, All the World Beside. And hey, go get yourself some ice cream. I know you guys are hungry for ice cream now after hearing that story. And we will see you with a full complement of players next week. Andrew will be back from Mexico. We'll be back from our trip to San Diego, hopefully with some fun stories to tell you. Until then, see ya.
Adios.
I love the energy that y'all bring to the podcast.